KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The continuing and changing legacy of the Washington State Constitution. We're going to take that up this hour. Also, a conversation with Ezekiel J. Emanuel, one of the brothers Emanuel. He's written a memoir of his American family. But we are going to start with a quick look at the Seattle Port, because the port has a new commissioner. Stephanie Bowman has been selected to join the Seattle Port. She's filling the seat that Rob Holland vacated after some controversy. Last month, Courtney Gregoire was picked to replace Gail Tarleton. So, two people selected out of 35 applicants. Tom Albro is with us. He is the head of the Port Commission, joins us from Eastern Washington, where he's attending an export forum. So why are you all the way in Eastern Washington learning about exports, Tom Albro?
Well, actually, we're promoting them. Hey, thanks for having us on here.
Thank you.
You know, about half of our exports through the Port of Seattle are agricultural products from Eastern Washington. So we're talking hay in Ellensburg right now.
I see. Tell me something, since you brought it up, and I'm thinking about this for later in our show with John Talton. Are you working together with the Port of Tacoma, or are you trying to get business that they won't get?
No, I think we're working as a Puget Sound port in this instance. We'd like to be working together with Tacoma in more ways than we are today. But, you know, one of the customer visits we just had, it's very clear to them and to us, it's they need the Puget Sound ports being able to effectively provide them access to the global market. And that's the way we see it, too.
And you have to work together. Otherwise, if you compete, that just raises your costs or...
Yes, and also the investments that we both depend on, our transportation investments in the state, you know, with this proposed revenue package for 167 and 509 and completing I-90 through the pass and 395 and Highway 12. I mean, these are things that both of our ports depend on, and so we're really leaning in together on that and a bunch of other things.
So you had 35 applicants for two positions. Is that a low number?
No, I think that's a high number. I think it's a good number. I think it bears out by just the quality of the applicants and the difficulty we had picking finalists, and then, you know, really at the end of the day, whom we appointed. It speaks very well of the pool.
You did appoint these people. Usually we vote on port commissioners. So in this case, you got to be the will of the voters first time out, because the voters will choose their own port commissioners when the election comes up. What's special about these candidates, or these commissioners, I should say?
Yeah. Well, first, yeah, and voters will have a big say in terms of what Port of Seattle looks like and what their commission is. We have four positions that will be on the ballot. So these two that we just appointed in Commissioner Creighton's position and my own. So, yeah, voters will get the final say, as it should be. What really stood out to us was the understanding of the export nature of Washington's economy and the opportunities that we had as a commission to be able to help the area, the region of Puget Sound region, but also I would say Washington State, really leverage the opportunities that port facilities make, not just seaport facilities, but airport facilities and other things. Both of them are well-versed in that area, and I think effective and understand that as port commissioners, we represent, you know, the people of King County, and our first call is to serve them and their interests. So they're very publicly minded, and I think have the kind of sophistication to learn quickly, because there's a lot to learn. They're willing to do the work. And that's not only the work of being a port commissioner, but that's the work of being a candidate in the electoral process.
Stephanie Bowman worked at the Port of Tacoma for 5 years. She's executive director for the Washington Asset Building Coalition. What is that?
She will be able to describe it much better than I, but it is a nonprofit that actually helps Washingtonians build net worth, particularly those with modest financial means through home ownership and many other things. So it's a great organization. I don't know very much about it, but I would encourage you to ask her about it.
What does she bring those two experiences? What is she bringing specifically to the port?
Well, I think that her knowledge of Tacoma and gives her the opportunity to see how the ports of Seattle and Tacoma can work more closely together, which is something that we're very keen on in Seattle. And I also think it one of our objectives, and it's our commitment in our Century Agenda strategic plan, is that we're here to create opportunity for all. We're not here for just some. And I think she just bears that out in her other work.
And Courtney Gregoire, she has a famous last name, but she has her own skills as well. What is she bringing to the Port Commission?
Well, she actually has national experience dealing. She was at the Department of Commerce on her own right and had increasing responsibilities there, U.S. Department of Commerce, and is very familiar with the interplay between national, I would say, export strategies and how we locally can be plugged into that. You know, our Century Agenda is that we want to grow exports. We want Washington's economy does a lot better because we don't have to consume everything we make here. Can you imagine how many airplanes we would have if we only had to, you know, meet our own demand for aircraft? No, we export stuff, and this is true for hay in Eastern Washington. It's true for airplanes, and it's true for a lot of other things, too.
Do they get a specific portfolio when they come onto the commission?
You know, it's too early to say. What we will be doing is kind of organizing ourselves. We are a team, and it's important that the commission actually work as a team. We don't have to agree all the time, but we do have to work collegially with each other, and I can say in kind of a common thrust of purpose. And so we'll be organizing ourselves to best maximize our impact.
All right. Tom Albrow, I thank you for bringing us up to date. Much appreciated.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
Tom Albrow is the head of the Seattle Port Commission. Stephanie Bowman and Courtney Gregoire have been appointed to be Port Commissioner members. They'll be facing election and the voters in November. This is Weekday.
It's 9:12. Ezekiel Emanuel is a bioethicist and head of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. His new memoir is Brothers Emanuel, a memoir of an American family. We're going to talk with him in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the graduate programs at Chapman University, located in Orange County, California, offering master's or doctoral degrees in 40 programs. Accreditation and graduate admission information at chapman.edu/graduate degree.
52 degrees in Seattle under a clear blue sky. It's sunny outside, the mountains are out, and it's going to stay that way all day with an afternoon high of 68. A few clouds overnight with a low of 46, and then sun again tomorrow with a high of 64. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:13.
Ezekiel Emanuel is a professor, the head of the Department of Medical Ethics, Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He has held the position of chief of the Department of Bioethics at the Clinical Center of the U.S. National Institute of Health. But he's also the older brother of Rahm and Ari Emanuel, prominent Democrat, current mayor of Chicago, the other a powerful Hollywood agent. Maybe you've seen the TV show Entourage. It's said his life has been inspired, has inspired that character. He's written a new memoir. He tells his story about his family in Brothers Emanuel. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely.
Is it fact that Ari on Entourage is based on Ari Emanuel?
Yes, that is fact. I can't tell you anything more because I've never seen the TV show.
That's right. You don't watch television? You have no television?
I haven't since I was 18 years old. I have not had a TV.
Well, maybe that's the secret of the Brothers Emanuel.
It's certainly one secret for me, although my brother obviously makes his money and has lots of TVs in his house.
And he watches them.
Yes. And growing up, we actually had a TV and would watch them, but that was growing up, and that was 60s TV. That was the Dick Van Dyke Show and things like that.
Rahm Emanuel, does he watch television?
Yes.
He has to.
Of course. Right.
He has to see what they're saying about him.
Exactly. He's very worried about that.
Passion, energy, persistence are the hallmarks of the Emanuel style. Define that for me. That's what you say. So define that for me a little bit more.
Well, I think all of us are very passionate about what we do and are, I think in the current phrasing, all in. No matter what we do, you get the full Emanuel and the full energy. And so I think that
I think you just made up a new phrase, the full Emanuel.
And I think the second is we are energetic, and I think we inherited that, as I argue in the, at the end of the book, from my dad, who was a tireless worker and really was up early, worked late, and always seemed to have energy for everyone.
You did. You said that was a little bit of genetics in that, aspect.
I think so.
He was somebody who was – that was his genes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're all sort of runners and athletes. You're all –
Right. And we also are – My brother, Ari, who lives in L.A., sometimes will call me. I'll still be in bed, and he'll be working out in L.A. 3 hours ahead. I was like, Ari, it's 4:30 there. Don't you sleep? So everyone thinks we don't sleep a lot, but I think it's not a matter of sleep. It's a matter of that when we're awake, we're really going.
Wait, are you an eight-hour night person or less?
I can't get 8 hours a night, but I do.
What do you get?
I get about six and a half.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And you're fine. You don't feel sleep deprived.
I don't know. You'll tell me whether I'm fine.
But you feel, well, you're a doctor. You don't feel sleep deprived. Everybody has their own rhythms, right?
So. Yeah. No, I probably am a little shorter than other people, but not tremendously shorter.
And persistence? What is that?
Yeah, I think we don't give up. And I think our mother especially trained us to keep going. And, you know, even if you have a failure, you get frustrated, just to keep moving, pick yourself up if you fall down. And I think we are persistent, and we always try to reach goal, and we don't give up, even unpopular things. And I'll just give you one example. When I started as a bioethicist, I was as junior as you could be. Actually, I was a graduate student when I began working in the area of end-of-life care. And when I told the dean of students at Harvard Medical School that I wanted to stop and go do a PhD and work on end-of-life care, he basically said, that's a career ender. You know, in the early 1980s, we don't work on end-of-life care. And even later, one of the heads of the hospital where I worked, and a big article came out with me endorsing various ways of improving end-of-life care. He brought me into his office and says, you can't publish from here. We don't deal with end-of-life care. And I persisted, you know, and it turned out that I was, in that case, prescient. I had anticipated where the field would go, and I anticipated that this would be a major issue. And, you know, so we were there early, and I've done that several times.
How did you persist? What did you publish from that institution?
Yeah, I just kept writing, and I just kept looking for the cutting edge as what was the most important question and go after it. And I've continued that kind of pattern.
They have enough. They saw enough value in what you were doing not to kick you out the door.
As I describe in the book, there were two other doctors at the institution who came to my rescue. Basically, the head of the training program, who said, "I'll read everything he does and I'll make sure he does it well." And the head of the breast cancer program, who was a big supporter and thought this was very important stuff that we ought to have a lot more of it in healthcare. And what's amazing is. He came to one of my speeches in San Francisco just 2 days ago and began telling me stories that I didn't even know about, you know, how they admitted me to the hospital and things like that.
See, I think that's interesting that you write, this is about family, this is about your brothers, but as you write, but mentors were a big part of, were they big parts of your other brothers' successes as well?
Absolutely. So Ari and I shared one high school mentor together, a guy named Bill Sanders. He was my debate coach, and he was Ari's high school advisor. And to both of us, he was pivotal. We still email with him. He was pivotal to me to sort of focus me and control me during debates. He had only partial success. And Ari, he was very instrumental in getting Ari through high school and focus. Ari was... before they were common terms, you know, ADHD and completely hyperactive and had terrible dyslexia, just terrible dyslexia. And he started out in high school really behind the eight ball. And it was only through Bill Sanders, my mother's persistence, and another teacher, a special education teacher named Gibby, who helped him through and made sure, A, that he graduated, that he got to college and not vocational school, and that people recognized his intelligence, because a lot of people in the education system, certainly in the 60s and 70s, thought he wasn't applying himself, he was lazy, he just wasn't that smart, all of which are false.
You had ADHD, ADD, what did you say? Which are the afflictions you carry?
I had a version of dyslexia, which is inability to spell.
You and your mother, bad spellers.
Yeah, and Rom, everyone in our family. I've also passed on that dyslexia gene. I have my middle daughter's had very bad dyslexia.
But you also said that you're one of those people in the back of the room. You're always moving your leg.
Right. My feet were always moving. I couldn't sit still in a chair. But it was not nearly as extreme as Ari's.
But it was part of the genetics.
Yeah.
Did that help you?
Both helped and hindered.
Yeah. Where did it help you?
It helped me in the energy thing and the ability to do lots of things. So I think one of the things that characterizes my brothers and I is that we can have six or seven balls in the air and not drop them. And I think people are often surprised by the number of conversations I can carry on simultaneously.
But isn't that interesting that in many ways today, now that it is a diagnosis, it's seen as a stigma.
Right.
As it was in the past, but without diagnosis.
Right.
How do we make it not a stigma, but a positive as well?
Well, so I can, I was growing up and wasn't fully aware of Ari's abilities, but one of the things Ari can do is he has a great memory, trained because he couldn't read. So he used to go over the passages and sort of memorize them if he happened to be called on in class. He can do a lot of math in his head. I have a daughter who has bad dyslexia. And one of the things I notice with her is she has word choice and describes things in ways that no one else would, and yet they're incredibly imaginative, creative ways of describing them. And she now writes children's books. And I think those abilities are ways you compensate for dyslexia as long as it's not you're not stigmatized and it's not made to be a bad thing. People see the positive in it. But you also have to train those kids to read because so much of what we need to understand in the world is through books.
All right. So Ezekiel Emanuel is author of Brothers Emanuel, a memoir of an American family. What did your mother offer you? What kind of training and focus did she offer you growing up?
So my mother never went to college, but she was very active in the civil rights movement early on. And when she came back to the United States from Israel, my parents moved to Israel in 1957. I was born there, but then they returned to the United States. She became active in the civil rights movement. She was active in the CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality.
She started a chapter, right?
She started a chapter, and she communicated, among other things, to us, first, the strong commitment to social justice, that you have to do and make sure that other people are better off because you're in the world, and that you really have to be committed to that, not just the family, but the larger society. Second thing she did is to communicate both in deed and word that, you know, other people might not think what you're doing is right, but you don't follow the crowds. You follow your own independent judgment of what the right thing to do is, and you do it, even if other people are making fun of you.
Even if it's personal, even if it's at the personal level, like your leg is tapping too much or your brother can't spell.
Yeah. Yeah, and she made sure that we were never followers, as it were, but always thought independently for ourselves. Third thing she did is she supported us when we got in trouble in school, and I put that in quotes. One of the stories I tell in the book is about my gym teacher. One day, you know, we were in a Jewish day school, a lot of hyperactive, really smart, but not very coordinated kids. And we were out of control. And he screamed, "Line up." And he was like really mad. And we're going to have order here. And you're going to call me sir. And if you don't think you can should call me sir, but listen to my orders, step forward to the line. I stepped forward to the line. And he got really pissed off, sent me off to the principal. And, you know, Mav comes into school again. And, you know, she doesn't say, you know, "What'd you do wrong?" When she walks into the principal's office, she says, "Yeah, he was right. Being called sir is something that a teacher has to earn. It's not something he can command." And so, you know, that was the support we got from my mom, that the presumption is that we were doing something right, not we were doing something wrong.
But you and your brothers also had to support your mother or figure out how to work with your mother, who had a, I believe, as you put it, a mercurial temperament.
Yeah, so my mother was, she was this very loving person. Every night before we went to bed, she would read us stories. She would decompress us and sort of talk to us about the day. But she also felt that she she needed the right attention and right caring, and we were not, you know, three wild boys and a husband who was a strictly utilitarian. We're not necessarily gave her the right attention, especially around birthdays or anniversaries or Mother's Day, and that would send her off, and she would feel like she wasn't fully appreciated, and she could both be hot-tempered and cold, sometimes the silent treatment, which was the worst, the absolute worst. Could go on for a while. And the boys had to, you know, we powwow and had to figure out how could we get her to feel better. I think actually that turned out to be one of the things that bonded us because we would work together, sort of reason together. How could we be, you know, do the dishes, keep the room clean, don't yell, don't fight. You know, that did last too long. But
it's interesting, though. Then another voice would have called your. I think you and I both know, growing up, what kind of statement we would have been made about our mothers if our mothers had been like that, right? Oh, you have a Jewish mother.
Yeah.
But that was also for you. You saw the positive in that as well.
Oh yeah. No, I think mom. You know, mom would not. She wouldn't let us rest, and she would constantly be pushing us. And so,
do you remember, by the way, some of the early demonstrations that you were taken to, and how old you were?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So we went very early, but I remember being 5 and 6 years old going to demonstrations. I mean, the thing which is most remarkable, I think, to a kid is there weren't that many children. We did have a friend, Roz and Alan Dean, and they had kids who went to demonstrations, and they were black. And so we, black kids, Michael and Clifton, we also had black friends, which was highly unusual in that era. And it was very common for us to have black people over to the house or to go to their house on the west side. And that we knew was quite unusual. We held signs, you know, we sang "We Shall Overcome."
You're a little 5-year-old holding a sign on one demonstration, weren't you?
Yeah, exactly. So those were our common experiences. Again, this is my mother, not intentionally, but teaching us that, you know, other people think you're wrong, you know, think integration's wrong, but you do what's right and you don't follow the common view. And again, one of the things I point out is my mom did this well before this was common for white middle class people, much less women, to be doing. She went to the March on Washington, famous 1963 march. Was there with Dr. King's "I Have a Dream" speech, and it, you know, made a huge difference on her and consequently the family.
One more thing on your life growing up on that aspect. You lived in the city, Chicago.
Yeah.
You were pretty free as kids to roam the city,
right?
And you wanted to go down to the lake. You went down to Foster Avenue Beach,
right?
Why did you go there? And what happened there?
Well, we lived half a block from Foster Avenue Beach, and so we would walk to the park, and from the park underneath the an underpass under Lakeshore Drive, and we were at the beach. So it was a, you know, 7-minute walk maximum. That was our hangout. You know, the beach is like Central Park in New York, or I don't know what the equivalent is here.
Lake Washington.
Lake Washington. And that's where you spent your summers. We were not camp kids. We were not organized activity kids. But this was a beach which was supposed to be, supposed to be open, but the kids enforced, or the people around enforced, all white beach. Ram and Ari have my mother's skin, and it gets very, very dark with just 2 or 3 days of sunshine and dark curly hair. And Ram in particular used to frequently be mistaken for African-American. And so we were told, you know, no niggers allowed on the beach, and get off. And, you know, you either get off or you stand up for yourself.
So what did your father tell you? What was his statement?
So my father taught us chess, not successfully because none of us play chess. But he used to always say, you know, offensive the best defense. And the other thing they communicated to us is you can't be bullied. If you back down to a bully, you know, you will never be able to do what you want or need to do. And so we would stand up to bullies, and I think we would always be tough. We'd be willing to take the blows, and we'd be willing to respond in kind. We did not start fights, but we would not back down. I also say in the
fights?
Book.
You had fights then?
Oh, yeah.
Punches were thrown.
Blood was shed, yes, commonly.
Commonly.
But we would not, yeah, I mean, we were not brothers who backed down, and especially to bullies. And I think that's a hallmark of, you know, someone tries to intimidate us. There is a response, a sort of natural response that animals do and humans do. It's called the fight or flight response. Threatened, what do? Do you fight or do you fly? And the Emmanuel brothers fight.
Were you together when that was that? Always the case that when you were together, that's how you would
I don't
react.
Know that always the case, but that we were together. But yes, we would not back down, right? Exactly. We would fight, and we were, we would coalesce. I say this in the story. You know, when we went home, we would fight among ourselves, you know, for whatever it was we were doing, playing to who would be on the – who would get to the top bunk. But when we went out, it was solidarity, and I always knew that my brothers had my back, and they always knew that I would be in front and be willing to defend them. And
so how'd that influence you when you were alone, you know, when you're on your own and you weren't all together as a pack?
You still did the same thing. I mean, we didn't change behavior in that regard. So,
Ezekiel Emmanuel has written Brothers Emmanuel. I want to talk a little bit about Israel. You say Israel was your second home. Your father was from there. He and your mother lived there for a little bit. You were born there, as you said.
Right.
You would return every summer for a long time.
So right after the 1967 war, when American Jewish community was sending money to Israel and supporting them, my parents decided, well, I said money, send the kids. So we went with my mother for the end part of June, July, and August, basically the whole summer. My mother's sister, Esty, moved there in 1957 when I was born and stayed. So packed into her very small apartment, basically a New York studio-sized apartment, were two relatively large women, three wild boys, and two dogs. Just imagine that. And we ended up spending the summer 67, 68, 69, and 70 there. Basically free. It was a very, you know, Tel Aviv was very safe. We were about two blocks from the beach, the Mediterranean beach, and we hung out at the beach all morning, came home, napped, played around, and then also toured the country. And
so how did Israel shape you?
I think there are two things. One is Ram, Ari, and I were together, and we had to entertain each other, whether it was jumping waves or body surfing or building sandcastles or jumping on the trampolines at the beach. We were together, and we bonded in sort of entertaining each other. Second, it's very much solidified our Jewish identity and the fact that, you know, this we felt like this was our homeland and this was a second home to us. We knew every street in Tel Aviv. We could easily move around the city. We felt very comfortable in that country and with the sort of mannerisms of Israelis.
You still take your daughters to Israel.
So I began returning when my eldest was born. She was 6 months old and went to Israel. And during the 90s, I spent brought my kids and spent a considerable a month at each go around with them. And the last time the whole family was in Israel was for Ram's and Ari's eldest children's bar mitzvah, and we all got together there. And
so what do you think the kids are getting from Israel?
My kids?
Yeah.
Well, my eldest took the first year after college and lived there and, again, got a lot of experience. She got a lot of experience in the peace movement, both working on the Israeli side and the Palestinian side. She worked in a hospital in palliative care counseling. And so she feels very comfortable in Israel, has a lot of friends there.
So you said Israeli character shaped you. And how? What was the Israeli characteristics that you bring back?
A little impatience, a little we'll tell you exactly what we think. I don't think anyone goes around the world and says, oh, I wonder what the Emmanuel brothers think. They know exactly what we think. We've told them right to their face, whether they like it or not. And so I think those characteristics are very, very much Israeli.
So you said that people would ask you, what did your mother put in the cereal? And Maureen Dowd said, you know, what was in the cereal you guys ate to be these high-achieving, successful brothers?
Yeah.
But cereal is like made of lots of different ingredients. So in a way, cereal is not a bad metaphor for what you're talking about. You talk about loyalty. You talk about integrity.
Right.
You also talk about sarcasm, snobbery.
Oh, right.
Being willing to say what you think, no matter the consequences. So is that the cereal that makes you guys who you are?
It's certainly some of the elements. I do also think I would throw in there a lot of love and support As I said, my mom used to every night read to us on the couch. Almost any cockamamie idea we had, my mom would support us and give us, if it required money, money, but also indulge the fact that we would could do it. And so I think, you know, one time in sixth grade, a neighbor, Mitch Cohn, and I were building this scale model of a Welsh castle for our medieval history class. And for weeks and weeks, the entire family room floor was occupied with balsa wood, with clay, with cardboard. And, you know, Mom was – it was our house. It was always our house where that was done. And so we got a lot of indulgence in that. And we were rarely scolded for some crazy scheme. Even, you know, I tell this funny story that Ari, during the streaking fad, mooned a undercover cop, and they hauled him in. You know, my dad said, keep the boy. You know, it's like no one got punished for doing that kind of stuff in our house.
Though, didn't they leave him there a little longer?
They did leave him there long, but he didn't get punished. He didn't say get grounded for a month.
Because he was a rambunctious mooner.
It's just us. So,
and by the way, your father is in this book. He's a presence in this book. Was he part of your – was it the four of you or was it the three of you and your father was to one side and your mother to another? Like,
No, it was definitely the three of us. And my father was – you know, we do have a lot of – as I said, a lot of his characteristics, the energy, the, you know, offense is the best defense, the I don't care what everyone thinks, we're going to do the right thing. My father frequently – he has these phrases. And one thing is use common sense. You know, he's a doctor. He hated when his students would, like, come up with all these zebra diagnoses, they're called. You know, the rarest thing possible. He says, just use common sense. You know, what's in front of you? Don't think about all the rare infectious diseases. But he also had this incredible capacity when it didn't fit to figure out what was unusual and to go after it. But he's also incredibly focused. You know, if there's a problem, my dad will just work at till it solves. So no kid who came in with a rare diagnosis, it was very unusual for my father not to think about it and figure it out.
Did you go into medicine because of him? Did he inspire you in that way?
I wouldn't have said inspired.
What would you say?
As the book makes clear, I was a reluctant. I am a reluctant doctor. He wanted me to become a research professor, sort of classic academic doctor. Go do immunology research, and I worked in a lot of labs, but I never liked the process of working in the lab, and I was very resistant, and they insisted I go to medical school. So after college, I went to Oxford for 2 years to do basic biomedical research. I didn't really like it. Went to medical school because I hadn't been able to articulate an alternative. Really did not like medical school. Too much memorization, too much hierarchy. You always said whatever the professor wanted you to say. I went down after my first year of school to Washington to write for the New Republic, but realized two things there. One, at that point in my life, I wasn't such a hotsy-totsy writer. Rick Hertzberg, who was then editor of the New Republic, helped me with my writing, and I really worked on it for 6 years to make it good. But I also figured I didn't want to report on what was happening. I wanted to actually make the news and make policy. Went back to Harvard Medical School and actually had a the experience during my second year of also teaching at Harvard College undergraduate.
See, but you did something. You sort of acquiesced. Acquiesce is the wrong word.
No, I did acquiesce. That's exactly the right word.
Okay, but I wanted to be kinder. But okay, you acquiesced, and that surprises me given the description you make of your lives.
Well, I acquiesced to my parents.
Yeah,
almost no one else. Yeah,
but you did.
I did. But then I reshaped it to my own liking. I stopped medical school and went off and did this PhD and became a bioethicist. And my father was like horrified.
Yeah, what is that, huh?
Exactly. What's that? No one ever gets a professorship. How are you going to do that? How can you make a career? And I showed him you can, you know, you persisted. Offense is the best defense. You just keep going. And
so you have your front piece is by Mark Twain. An autobiography is the truest of all books, for while it inevitably consists mainly of extinctions of the truth, shirkings of the truth, partial revealments of the truth, and he goes on, in the end, the results being the reader knows the author in spite of his wily diligences. So do we know you in spite of your wily diligences to leave some things out?
Well, let me make two comments to that. The first one is, when I began writing this, everybody said, if you don't do the truth, you can forget it. No one's going to read it. They'll see right through it. You can't not do the truth. And the second thing is, as my youngest daughter said when she read the book, all the characters ring true. And so I think you do have all the characters ringing true, and you do have the truth in this book, and it inevitably comes through. So
good.
I hope I succeeded.
And your brothers are still talking to you.
Yeah.
Brothers Emmanuel, A Memoir of an American Family, Ezekiel J. Emmanuel, author. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. This has been great.
I appreciate you talking to us.
Great.
This is Weekday.
It's 9:39, contemplating individual rights and the Washington State Constitution in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan and the 100% electric Nissan Leaf, whose drivers have driven more than 150 million miles gas-free. More at NissanUSA.com.
54 degrees and sunny in Seattle. They say we're going to reach 68 this afternoon. Few clouds overnight, but then sunny again tomorrow with a high of 64.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Opera, presenting La Voix Humaine with Swore Angelica. Poulenc and Puccini present two stories of women on the verge in this new-to-Seattle double bill. May 4th through 18th at McCaw Hall. Details at seattleopera.org.
It's 9:40. You may recall earlier this week we heard about a terror plot that was foiled by Canadian police. One of the suspects gave what's being described as a rambling statement in court today in Toronto. We'll get an update from Vaughn Palmer, our man in Canada, in 25 minutes. Perhaps he'll update us with a rambling statement of his own.
Why not? He often does. Oh, I shouldn't say that. He never does.
25 minutes.
Yeah, he'll be taking me to task. I think we know who rambles. All right, but first, the Washington State Constitution is a 19th century document rooted in populist traditions of the era. It still functions today, and it is an elaborate document, I think we find again when we look at it. Hugh Spitzer is an affiliate professor, University of Washington School of Law. He's also with Foster, Pepper, and Scheffelman, PLLC. P, what's the P stand for?
Professional.
Professional. I'm sorry. I just was curious. And a new edition of the Washington State Constitution book is coming out, or is out, from Oxford. It's part of a series of Oxford commentaries on the state constitutions of the United States. And an excuse to talk about, this is a pretty elaborate document, the Washington State Constitution.
Yeah, it is. State constitutions tend to be a little more detailed than the U.S. Constitution. U.S. Constitution was written for the ages. And was written in the Enlightenment period. It's a spare document. It really was meant to change. That's what John Marshall said, and didn't have as much detail as some of the state constitutions.
Did something change as the writers of constitutions moved west?
Yes, as people moved west and as the nation grew. The concerns and struggles changed, and people, particularly in the West, as the West moved across the West, farmers primarily got grumpy about the East Coast and the financial centers. They didn't have enough currency. They felt that there were too many monopolies around, and it was really the Jacksonian movement in the 1830s and then the 40s that started changing state constitutions. Indiana, Iowa, we start getting these detailed constitutions with a lot of protections for farmers and later on for working people.
How does the Washington State Constitution compare with, if you've looked at them, Oregon, which was earlier, or California, which was a little earlier as well?
So Washington draws more from Oregon and California than any other constitutions. In fact, the state from that settlers in Washington came from, those people who, the non-Indian settlers in 1889, when our state constitution was written, more of them came from California than anywhere else. Things haven't changed in that regard. And their state constitution came with them and Oregon. But Oregon was based on Indiana. And Indiana was one of these populist or proto-populist documents.
Are the Jacksonian influences and the populist influence of a line, or is there some distinction? Because I don't always think of Jacksonian era politics as being as fair to all.
Well, certainly it wasn't fair to non-whites, but and it wasn't fair to women, but it was much more fair based on income. And so what you saw as the nation grew in the 19th century was an expansion of the franchise. More and more people got to vote. And what the Jacksonian era brought was universal suffrage, universal voting rights for at least white males across the country. And with that brought a lot of changes because we really became a democracy at that point.
Hmm. Hugh Spitzer, along with former Justice Robert Utter, have put out the second edition of the Washington State Constitution. Which provisions do you enjoy the most, if I may ask that way, in terms of the history that we're talking about?
Well, you know, one of my favorites is actually the state seal. In terms of what's enjoyable. Because it was created after a lot of debate over whether there should be commercial slogans in the Washington State Seal in 1889. They finally decided just to put George Washington's picture in the middle. And so a fellow who was an engraver drew a seal with a couple of circles, stuck a postage stamp in the middle, and that's the way it was done. But one of the other fun ones is the very first provision, which is the preamble, which says, "We, the people of the state of Washington, grateful to the supreme ruler of the universe for our liberties, do ordain this Constitution." And they spent a couple of days arguing over whether or not to even mention the supreme ruler of the universe or how to mention him or her. There were a lot of free thinkers who were delegates. Doesn't matter whether they're Democrats or Republicans. There were people, one fellow said that even mentioning God was a chief advertisement of belief that had no place in a document intended for business purposes. And when they
finally— I thought that was interesting that they said business purposes.
Yeah,
too.
It is. But I guess the business of government. But when they finally agreed on supreme ruler of the universe, which was fairly vague, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer wrote, "It finally ended in the complete rout of the heretics and the triumph of the hosts of the Lord." So people back then had a great sense of humor. They were also very good writers because back then they actually read books. And so there are portions of the Constitution and the Constitutional Convention that it's just fun to read.
Do you find this a well-written document in terms of its legal prescriptions?
Yes, basically it is. State constitutions tend to be more detailed than the U.S. Constitution. So we look more at the original intent and meaning than with the U.S. Constitution. But it's pretty well written. In fact, I would say as we moved on after 1889, the provisions got longer, they got more detailed and more obscure than they originally were.
I was struck by the militia section.
Oh, yeah.
Just that Article 10, just that it is here in one thing. Who's liable to military duty? All able-bodied male citizens of this state between the ages of 18 and 45, except such as are exempt by laws of the United States or by laws of this state, shall be liable to military duty. How was that implemented? How is that implemented?
Well, the militia was very important because there was very limited access to federal troops if necessary. If there were problems, and there had been problems earlier between the white settlers and the Native Americans, so there was a need for a militia and in the case of some kind of emergency. And so all men, other than those having conscientious scruples against bearing arms, were required to do militia duty. And they did. And the officers were in the cadets at the University of Washington. They trained as just like ROTC. The young men at the university were in the cadets and would become militia officers. And they called out those cadets during the anti-Chinese riots in 1886, in fact. This is 3 years before the Constitution was written.
The other thing that we hear often about the Constitution right now is the Constitution's direction for spending on public education. And there's a whole section on that, but this section one, the preamble, sort of sets it up, right? It is the paramount duty of the state to make ample provision for the education of all children residing within its borders without distinction or preference on account of race, color, caste, or sex.
Yeah.
And, of course, the ample provision has been the one we stumble around.
Right. In 1978, the Washington Supreme Court ruled that that wasn't really a preamble. Actually, the word preamble and the other headers in the different sections came in later than 1889 by editors. And the state Supreme Court said that's a real section. It means what it says, and it is the paramount duty of the state to provide amply for public now K-12 schools. It's a very interesting provision. You'll notice that it requires education of all kids residing within our borders, doesn't matter what their citizenship is, and also without distinction or preference on account of race, color, caste, or sex. That language, for years, nobody knew where it came from. One of my students did some detective work, and she found that it came from the Florida Reconstruction Constitution right after the Civil War. And then when federal troops left the South after the 1876 election, it was promptly amended out of the Florida Constitution, but it turned up in ours and nowhere else.
Nowhere else in the country?
Nowhere else in the country is this strong protection for equal education and treatment of kids regardless of sex or color. Very interesting.
That is.
Only here.
Well, are there any other examples that you have found in looking at this Constitution?
Where things that are peculiar?
Yes.
No. I haven't found any that are
that's a good one
unique. This is completely unique. At least today it's unique.
So the whole idea of education and through the Constitution is quite elaborate. You have all these different sections about sectarian control, about how it's paid for, funds for support. Are other constitutions equally detailed in funding for schools in their constitutional documents?
No. It's very common for state constitutions to have language like our Article 9, Section 2, which says that the legislature shall provide for a general and uniform system of public schools. That we see all over the country, common schools provisions. They come from Horace Mann, who was in the 1820s and 30s from Massachusetts, an educator, lawyer, legislator, who was the crusader for public schools. Everybody's got that, but nobody else has this strong, ample provision language that we have. And you also mentioned the no sectarian education provision. There are a number of states that have that. My co-author, Justice Robert Utter, did a fascinating article some years ago about the history of that language. And there are things that you don't want to know about in a sense, or that are negatives about the history of pieces of our Constitution. And that was meant as an anti-Catholic provision. It was meant to ensure that no public money would go to parochial schools because the majority at the time were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, mainline Protestants. And there was a national movement to ensure that these Catholic immigrants wouldn't get money to their Catholic schools, and it would just be the common schools, the public schools that got this money. In the 1886 election, or it would have been 86, 84, 84 election, 88, 88 election, the Washington Republican delegation from the territory to the Republican National Convention supported a Senator Blaine for president, and he was pushing a U.S. constitutional amendment that would essentially ban any public money for parochial schools, and that language wound up in our Constitution a year later.
Why is Hugh Spitzer and Justice Robert Utter have put out a second edition of the Washington State Constitution as part of the Oxford Commentaries books of constitutions. Why is it important? Why is it personally important for you to be involved in this project? You're not just you're annotating this book. You're giving a historical and contextual perspective.
Right. I've been writing about the Washington Constitution for years, and of course, Justice Utter, my co-author, for more years. When he was on the Supreme Court, he and Justice Dolliver and others, but Justice Utter was really the leader, pushed the concept that because they are a state Supreme Court and we are a state, that state constitutions are real. And people had forgotten about state constitutions after the New Deal and World War II, when the federal government grew so much and became the focus of people's political concentration. And people started to forget about the states. And certainly lawyers forgot about the state constitution because the U.S. Supreme Court was so dominant. And Justice Utter led the movement, really, to looking back at our state constitution. And this is very important because state constitutions, besides providing important rights like the right to education, public education, they provide personal rights, most state constitutions, that are much stronger than those protected in the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was an afterthought. It was originally meant to make sure that the federal government, which was weak back in the late 18th century, that the federal government would not violate people's rights. But states had a lot more powers than the federal government at that time, and they still do over people's lives, like marriage, property, contracts, things like that. Marriage being a big one, of course, on everybody's plate these days. And so the rights needed, in a sense, more protection from the states than the federal government. So we had much more explicit rights. We, for example, in this state, there's an explicit right of the individual to bear arms, which you don't see in the U.S. Constitution. And our right to privacy is quite explicit. And so prosecutors and defenders nowadays, they think more about Article 1, Section 7 having to do with privacy rights than they do about the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure. And it's much more the focus these days.
It's also just so fascinating. You look at the Declaration of Rights, political power, law of the land, personal rights, right of petition, freedom of speech, oaths, mode of administering oaths. They were imprisonment for debt, eminent domain. They were very specific in their charge.
Well, you needed these things because in 1876, the U.S. Supreme Court said that, or I guess reaffirmed that most of the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states. They had said that before, and it's only in the mid-20th century that we start seeing the U.S. Supreme Court extending the U.S. Bill of Rights to state action as opposed to federal action. So you needed to have these specific protections from state government in state constitutions.
Why did the I know this is off the subject a little bit. Why did the courts rule that?
Well, the Bill of Rights, U.S. Bill of Rights, was added to the Constitution in order to help get the U.S. Constitution passed in Virginia and New York, because the anti-federalists or the anti-new Constitution people in 1888 were saying that this federal government would get so large and so powerful that it would start impinging on people's rights. And James Madison and others who were supporting the new Constitution said, well, how could that happen? The federal government will never grow large. It will never be very important. It really doesn't do very much. It's there for national defense and currency and so on. So, but in order to get it passed, they went along with it. So we got the Bill of Rights. But in a case called Barron versus Baltimore, the court, as the Marshall Court, ruled that 25 years later, 30 years later, that the Bill of Rights doesn't protect people from the states, only from the federal government.
So the states, many states took that to heart. The writers of constitutions took that to heart to make sure that idea of individual liberty moved out into the states.
Exactly, and that it was protected in the states. And then the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, the privileges and immunities provision, was meant to extend the Bill of Rights to the states, but the Supreme Court reinterpreted that one very soon after the Civil War and the slaughterhouse cases from New Orleans. And so once again, we didn't have the Bill of Rights covering the state. So we've got these strong protections for liberties, civil liberties, in our state constitution and many others.
Well, it is. You know, it's a living document, isn't it?
And it is a living document.
It continues to be a living document. That's what's so fascinating about all these documents. The Washington State Constitution, second edition. Justice Robert F. Utter and Professor Hugh D. Spitzer have put it out. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of a class of first graders in Juan de la Barrera Primary School in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. The teacher is leading them in a chant to refocus them, to remind them when it's time to be quiet.
Being loud to be quiet.
I like that. Weekday listener Elizabeth sent in that sound. Her family was in Puerto Vallarta last summer on a spring break trip with the John Stanford International School where her kids attend. If you're hearing some interesting sounds around the world, send them to us. And write sound of the day in the subject line. Send it to weekday@kuow.org. More sounds of weekday ahead. Stay with us.
It's 9:59. U.S. authorities are in Russia to talk with the parents of the Boston Marathon bombing suspects. That and more of today's news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Cornish College of the Arts and Expo 13, May 10th through the 25th. Expo 13 builds upon the annual BFA exhibition, highlighting the...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.